Well, if it's okay with you, maybe we'll start with some of your recollections from that period of the star coming together and all of that.
Okay.
Really anything that sticks out to you or things that you recall?
Well, of course, my father founded two businesses that he founded and operated successfully over the years. He started the sign business in 1906 when he was 13, living in with his mother and father in the boarding house that my grandmother ran at 19 East Campbell Avenue. And my dad had the artistic talent. He began to do sign painting when he was just 13. And he's listed in the Roanoke City directory, directory, in 1908. He had formally started the Roy C. Kinsey Sign Company in 1907 when he was then 14, 15, but he was all registered then. He learned to be successful in all the fast growth of what was then Roanoke in the early 20s, teens and 20s. And his passion was animal husbandry. And 1925, he officially started the Highland Guernsey Dairy. And that's where we lived, where I grew up from my birth. I was 5 months old when I moved to that property location, where Countryside Golf Course.
Now, yes.
The home and silo and one barn, last barn we built, still there. I finished high school in 42.
Okay.
So at that time, my oldest brother and I particularly continued to operate the dairy, and we were deferred because of it, being a producing operation. I worked at that along with my brother Warren for about 4 years, 3.5 years. Then I joined the Navy, combat air crew, and I was gone with that for 16 months. So by the time I got back from that, I finally started to Roanoke College when I was on GI Bill. And I went for a year and a half. I was still going to college the last half, the first half of my sophomore year in 1949. But I officially then went to work from there on. I'd had a year and a half of college, but I'd had about 5 years of practical training. So I was, at the time we were building the Star to begin with, I was working some part-time, but I was also going to college a little bit during that period of time because I had a limited schedule. But anyway, I was doing that and working for the sign company when we built the Star. It's been a good bit of time working on it. I guess you've read some of the stories about my involvement in it. I flipped a switch instead of the mayor and all that.
Yes. Bit.
I guess you know Eric Brady.
Yes.
Photographer. Mm-hmm. He has quite a story. He proposed and had his wedding under the Star.
Is that right?
I proposed under the Star to my wife currently. So we've been married over 65 years. And we married in March of 50.
So this would have been right around the time the Star was first
erected. Yeah, because I was on site when they finished the Star. I was doing a lot of the electrical work, and I helped install the sections of faces on the frame. But a little bit in the putting in of the foundation, I had some time helping to pour concrete and build reinforcing cages and all that bit. So, but Eric It has his story, you know, the famous picture he made.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
He gave me a copy of it.
Oh, that was
framed. And I was hanging out there in the hallway. But anyway. So that's pretty much the beginning of it. So my story is, I was dating Lois in the summer of, started in the summer of 49, and was involved in finishing college and helping to build the Star. And then on Christmas Eve, we drove up together on a date, and I proposed, parked under the Star. I mean, directly under it. Then you could still drive up in between the front and back steel
columns. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
But anyway, that's my prime story.
Well,
but I've got, you know, lots of other
little
tidbits along.
Well, I'm curious. I've read, again, Nelson's chapter and some of the other material that we've got.
I don't. Do you have the Roanoker magazine? Did
yes.
An article. You have that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got and the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. We have. I'm not sure that I have everything that the newspaper did, but we have a fair bit of it.
Yeah. Well, I have extra copies of the Roanoker magazine and the newspapers.
Oh, wonderful.
And,
I'll go back and check our collection. Yeah. As I said, we've been pretty good about keeping track of those, every once in a while, one goes by.
Yeah. Well, talking about Cox, Cox called me to come over. This was in last fall when we were just celebrating the 65th anniversary of the Star. Mm-hmm. I did a little 7-minute program with the mayor.
Oh, I'll have to.
It's on Fox's Channel 9.
Mm-hmm.
I have a DVD of it if you need to see it, but they did that, so.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that there's, obviously people always think about the Star when they think about Roanoke. What was your impression of how people saw it when it was first built? Again, I've read the news stories, but that doesn't always tell you.
Did you read any of the comments by M. Carl Andrews?
A few, yes. Yeah. And we have some of his papers, actually, in the Virginia Room. I'm not sure whether he donated them or his family did.
Yeah.
But.
Well, he despised it. You ask about what people thought of it.
Well,
it is just a neon sign. And at that time, the people of knowledge thought it was garish.
Mm-hmm.
He tried about 3 or 4 times by putting an article in the editorial page, because he's the editor of the editorial page.
Right.
Trying to get it moved. He wanted to get it taken down, moved over on Reed's Mountain, or anything to get it away from up there.
Mm-hmm.
He was chairman of the Mill Mountain advisory committee, I guess you'd call it.
Right.
And a little irony today, they did a bronze plaque to him, noting that he was the chairman of the committee and his contribution to the mill. Guess where it is?
They put it up at the Star?
Right down where the Star's. If you get out on the, go out on the observation platform, and look right over the front edge.
Oh.
There it is, looking right straight back. Star's looking right down on it, day and night.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. The another person who called in with a story to us, actually, called in about her son, who wrote a report in school about the Star.
Well, you got one in that little.
Oh, yes. I saw that, and I wondered if it might have been the same person.
No, that's a young lady.
Oh, that is a young lady, okay.
Yeah.
He was told that there was a neighbor of his who had some involvement with the Star, and that he should talk to this person.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out to be Andrews.
Oh.
And so when his mother approached him about talking to the young boy, he said, well, he needs to make an appointment. So he made an appointment with Mr. Andrews' wife, and he came down one day, and Andrews came out dressed up, in a suit and all this, and sat down and spoke to the boy about the Star for quite a while. and apparently said nice things, since I didn't hear anything different from the mother.
It was Mr. Andrews, yes. Carl Andrews.
Yeah, Carl Andrews. Hmm. But that may have been sometime after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bern Yurt was kind of, he verbally was kind of against it for a while, but he softened and eased up on it. Now he's, of course, not involved, but, you know, that was public. He asked about people's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But when Mr. Andrews would run the editorial thing in the paper, the letters back to him would just blow him away. The general public just said, don't you dare touch it. I mean, there's one another thing in there that says, don't throw rocks at our star.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just the way. The general public, for some reason or other, just fell in love with it.
Indeed, yeah. Well, by 1952, 53, you see it in advertisements, media, and signs all over the place.
It picked up in a hurry.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Well, that's great. If there are any other memories or stories, anything like that, that you'd like to share, certainly I think our folks would love to hear them. However big or small, we've had all sorts of different kinds of stories. It's always interesting to hear what people have to say. But I'm trying to think if there's...
Well, it's gone through, because we, the Roy C. Kinzer Sound Company continued to maintain it.
Oh.
And they, for about 30, after it was given to the city of Roanoke, we still do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The difference in the colors and replacing it and upgrading it, all those things.
Yeah.
And we, of course, I still have my lineman's belt that I wore when I'd climb it, you know, replacing neon or transformers or whatever as it went along.
Yeah.
But the beginning story of the building of it, the sign company was given the contract to do it all. And we had three subcontractors. One was Roanoke Iron and Bridge Works, which you hear a good bit about. It was up to us to begin with to design it size-wise and what it was to be a five-point star, and then to tell this group that was paying for it how big it needed to be in order to be visible from that distance.
Okay.
We had rules of thumb that you use in the sign business, how big a letter it takes to be able to read it at a given distance.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a rule of thumb to that, and you go by that. In other words, a 12-inch letter is visible at 500 feet, legible. Mm-hmm. So you've got a kind of a basic rule as to what. We'd have sign company customers, they'd order a sign for their business, and we'd recommend how big it needed to be, and they'd come in the sign company where it's being built, and the customer would say, my Lord, that's so big, why? But then we would go out and put it up, it just shrinks down. when you have something indoors and then take it outdoors at a normal viewing distance, it shrinks.
Absolutely.
So that was our responsibility then, to tell the ironworks the specifications we needed for the steel frame.
Mm-hmm.
We determined, when we designed the faces to the star, how much square footage that came to.
Right. Right.
And you take, for a 100-mile-an-hour wind, you take the square footage times 30 pounds to the square foot, times the height center of the area, from there down to the ground, what that length is, and you multiply those out, you get a bending moment that you use then to determine the strength of the structure.
Okay.
And we gave all of that to Mr. Bob Little, who was the mechanical engineer for Roanoke Iron Bridge Works, and the shape we wanted, the height we wanted, and he designed the frame, support frame, accordingly. Mm-hmm. And we put in the foundation, concrete blocks and bolts. Whether you read the little story about the fact that the lightning never strikes it.
Yes. Yeah.
And while we just dug used a bulldozer and dug two trenches for the line of blocks front and another trench for the line of blocks at the back. Mm-hmm. We got five front, five back. Middle one is a big one that supports three legs, and then there's two out each way, single.
Right, get those edges.
Makes five blocks. The one in the middle is huge because that carries the three legs that go all the way to 100 feet. The other two don't. They just go out to the wing heights of the point. Mm-hmm. So, at that time, not too long after World War II, the origin of ready-mix concrete was in its early stages, and Roanoke Ready-Mix Concrete had their plant right there on Reserve Avenue.
Oh, yes.
And we, of course, contracted with them to furnish the concrete. And we contracted with Jefferson Electric Company to do our primary wiring. That's the 120 volt wiring coming in. We furnished a big switch box, and they supplied the contactor and circuit breakers and all in that went in that, and running the conduit up. We had supplied these boxes on the back, all around on the back of the star, to contain the transformer. Neon operates on high voltage.
Gotcha.
Anywhere from 1,000 to 15,000 volts, depending on the length of neon that each one would contain.
Right.
So that was the other subcontractor, those three, those two and us, and we had some outside people, a couple of firemen that helped doing painting, final. Ironworks had primed their steel framework, then we had to have it all painted white.
My goodness.
Anyway, that's the group that we had to help us.
Well, a lot of, as you say, local businesses that I think anyone who's been around Roanoke for a while or, you know,
well,
learned about the history at all has heard those
every
names.
Now and then somebody would pop up about having a part in building.
Wouldn't surprise me now.
No.
Right, right.
They're all welcome. We had good help.
Yeah.
And we had to struggle to get it all done in time.
Oh, really?
Well, that the story of the turning it on, I was up there all that afternoon making the final check on all the neon, all the different circuits. I'd turn on just one circuit and go around and make sure it was all in operation. And then you had to put it all together, of course, after you check it. And that's when they came to me wanting this little remote switch, and I said, no way. I got to unwire a whole lot and then hook that thing in, and then after it's over with, undo all of that mess. I said, no way.
Much easier to just stay out of
sight. And my brother Roy was up there. My brother Warren, the oldest, he was at home when it turned it on. And he was having a little difficulty physically at the time and had to go on home. But anyway, Roy and I were both up there. As you know, John Payne was there.
Payne, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's a macho man, and he wanted to show how much he was. And we had the construction ladder, which is permanent, doesn't come all the way down, purposely, so people can't just go up and go climbing up on it.
Right.
Although I could get up on it without an assistant ladder, but we had a section of ladder, and John had us to set that up so he could go on up on it. And stand out, there's a picture of him in there doing that. Mm-hmm. He's standing up there, kind of got his legs crossed, you know, and all like, oh, he just, you know, no problem at all. He's just quite agile.
Right.
And we had to put the ladder up, let him get up on it, and then take the ladder down and lay it over to one side while it took his picture up there.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother Roy is one of those pictures of him up there. If you look way over in the right-hand edge, there's my brother Roy standing there waiting to put the ladder up for him to come down.
Well, it seems like something that a lot of people wanted to be a part of, like you say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that the wire that we put down to ground it, properly ground it, mm-hmm. so the lightning never strikes it.
Right.
At 1948, the city of Roanoke had discontinued the streetcars. Right. And they'd taken all the trolley wire down and just rolled it up in rolls and had it down at the scrap metal yard. While we had the ditches open to build the, put in the foundation before we did any backfilling, we got a whole bunch of that wire and wound it all around down at the bottom, right around the base of the concrete blocks, mm-hmm. and brought it up to each leg and wrapped it around one of the anchor bolts. Mm-hmm. So it's all one big field of copper wire, and because the wire is actually has a hard tempered steel center for strength, because you had to stretch it to be the trolley wire.
Right.
It had
right.
to be taut to give it strength. It had that hard steel core, and then a heavy copper coating on it to carry the to be the conductor. Anyway, it was perfect for the job. So we just did that, and the lightning never strikes it.
That's right, yeah, I've never.
It keeps the star from ever building up a positive charge.
Okay.
That's the physical explanation. It never becomes an attraction
right.
to lightning.
Right.
Because the lightning is a negative charge coming out of the sky, and whatever it strikes is a positive charge.
Gotcha. So as long as you never build up that positive.
It's never an attraction.
Right.
The lightning ran in on the power line one time.
Oh.
And just blew the meter to smithereens.
Oh, my gosh.
But it didn't hurt anything other than that.
Well, that's good.
Because the meter socket has a grounding, heavy grounding
right.
Terminal on it that you drive a stake down and have that grounded. So it didn't go beyond the meter.
Hmm. Yeah,
but it sure did blow that meter. It just looked like it exploded in.
Oh my gosh.
The glass cover was all just shattered and shot away.
Well, but as you say, at least it didn't cause any further
damage. No, it didn't cause any damage to the star.
Hmm. Yeah, from what I've heard, the only real issue with stars these days is just getting those bulbs replaced. I imagine that's a job, isn't it, to get those down and...
To begin with, we had to do it by just climbing up there.
Right.
But
right.
once we got our 100-foot crane, you could just... And the street was opened good.
Oh.
But it was the street around all the way around to begin with.
Yeah.
But we just sit out in front of it and ride in a work basket and go up with that and change it.
A little easier that way, I guess.
The red does not deteriorate.
Oh, interesting.
It has to, you have to just, in order to kill it, you've got to break it. Break the seal.
Mm-hmm.
But the anything that has the powder coating, fluorescent is a misnomer. It should be phosphorescent.
Mm-hmm.
Because the powder coating inside of the glass is what you get a lot of your colors from. Phosphorus has about, the powders can contain about 50 some colors.
Hmm.
And you take just a clear tube, and they have the phosphorus powder in a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And you just dip the tube down in it and pull it out. And it coats the inside of the glass with a coating of that powder. That's the process of applying it.
Okay.
Well, that deteriorates over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
The white, particularly, you'll notice it, it'll begin to darken on the ends.
Right.
And it just fades down. The glow from the phosphor decreases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the electric arc causes the phosphor to glow. And the electric arc produces a whole lot of ultraviolet rays that we don't see in our visual range.
Okay.
But the phosphor does brings all those a lot of that source of light into our visible range. That's why you're what we call fluorescent lighting is so efficient.
Right, yes.
It doesn't produce any heat. It produces all light, and it accumulates more light than you normally would see by using that fluorescent or phosphorescent coating. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
You have two processes for making a neon light.
Mm-hmm.
One uses neon gas, and that's all. You just take a clear tube, seal it, and evacuate it, and add back about 10 centimeters of neon gas, and it's brilliant red. And it's red the same hot, cold, day, night, doesn't matter. It doesn't change with its life. Clear glass doesn't ever coat anything. And as long as it doesn't get fractured and lose its vacuum, once you create a vacuum, the electric arc, which in open air, which would jump about that much distance.
Oh my goodness.
Will jump about 70 or 80 feet in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's how good an insulation the atmosphere is.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's the principle.
Right.
You create a vacuum and the arc will jump between two gaps, electrodes. And you tie tubes in a series, and like I said, 50, 60, 70 feet, depends on the diameter of the tube.
Mm.
You've got 9 millimeter, 11 millimeter, 13 millimeter, 15 millimeter diameter tube you buy in 4 foot lengths.
Okay, yeah.
And that's because a neon operator, it technically is a glass bender. Now you take a professional, is a glass blower. He can take a glob of Pyrex glass and make a beaker or, you know, he's a glass blower.
Yeah.
Neon man's just a glass bender.
Mm-hmm.
You have a piece of material, for years we used asbestos paper.
Oh.
You draw the pattern of letters, particularly, or any shapes on this pattern, then you heat your glass, go over and you lay it down and get it to match the pattern as it cools. And you go through that process of making individual letters or decorations or whatever.
Right.
But
in the case of the star, I imagine you just used all straight lengths.
Yeah, it's just straight tubes.
Yeah, just no need to.
Now we did 100 at the same time, 3 foot stars. Downtown.
Hmm.
And they have all of that done by Thanksgiving.
You got somebody at your door.
Oh.
Well, I think at this point, if there's anything else that you would want someone to know who was, again, sort of unfamiliar with the star, something that either that only you would know or that it would just be good for them to know in general, I think that would be.
Well, I don't know. Since I retired, I got interested in Valley history, railroad, and everything in my family history. And since I'm a lifelong resident, native of the Valley, I've learned to appreciate it quite a bit. And my father, what he did for us, the three of us, for all of his siblings and so forth. But anyway, it started out to be just a Christmas decoration. And it just then became established a life of its own.
Right.
That nobody had in mind when we built it. But we did build it so that we would assure that it would stay there.
Right.
Like I said, we engineered it for 100 mile an hour wind plus the 30% safety factor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we gave Mr. Little to go by in his design. There are other stories. We took the faces that we made out to the airport and laid them down on an apron out there, unused apron at that time. It was big enough and flat enough, you know, flat and big enough that we could just lay it all down in just sheet-sized pieces and then put it together. You'll see sections of it being lifted up to go on the frame. And we put it together in small pieces with angle irons on the back, but it was bigger than this, the actual single pieces. So we put a series of those together in a group and then assembled all of that into one unit where we could pick it up, take it over there up to the mountain and lift it up. And it was designed to fit then onto the frame, there, existing frame.
Even with the road up there, I would imagine getting some of those pieces up the mountain was a challenge.
Of course, the ironworks had to bring their crane and their sections of already assembled sections up back from the Yellow Mountain Road up the ridge by the zoo.
Right.
And on over. And then we used their crane after they had put up the frame to lift our pieces in place.
Gotcha.
The concrete plant had, they were at the beginning of their industry and they had just old GI trucks that they'd bought mixer tubs to, and mounted on them to make the delivery with. They have on the back end where they fill the thing to begin with at the plant. It's a kind of a funnel shaped thing on the back end of the truck, and they pull onto a tipple and they drop the rock and drop the sand and all the ingredients into this mixing tub, portable or portable tub, so to speak. And that's the process. Of course, back then they only had about a 3-yard tub on them. Now they're about 12, 14 yards of concrete, huge vehicle.
Yeah.
But they were struggling when they'd get up there with a load of, and they couldn't bring a full load. And that thing down the back, the filler spout, was the highest point on the truck. And they had to take those off in order to get under the switchback bridge.
Oh, wow.
To get up to it. So they fill them and then, just because it was just a thing bolted on a shell, so there's no problem to just take it off and when they hit it up. They only put about a yard and a half of material in it. And then he was struggling when he got, we could stand up there and see him leave the plant there on Reserve Avenue and come across Walnut Avenue Bridge, and then he'd disappear under the foot of the mountain.
Right.
And about 30 minutes later, he'd show up there. Blowing steam, struggling to get up that mountain.
Yeah.
They had to deliver 130 yards of concrete up there, which was
a yard at a time.
Well, not much more, maybe a yard and a half, all like, depending on the truck.
Wow.
They were a mixture of GI trucks
right.
that they'd bought from the war.
Wow.
But anyway.
Quite an undertaking.
Like I said, we had to do 100 3-foot stars and hang them. At that time, we still had not put up the tall light poles in the downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
Just little low poles, which you've now gone back to, some of them.
Yeah.
But the big high ones were nice when they put those up. But the year before, first year we put them up, we just had to hang them on whatever we could find, brace wires, cables. Anything we could find to hang them on.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother Roy was pretty much involved in that. And Warren and I were up on the mountain mostly. But anyway.
Just looking for places to hang them up, like you said.
Yeah, and then we had to have a whole flock of Boy Scouts to plug them up when nighttime came.
Yeah.
When they put up those new poles in 1950, they were perfect to hang it on. We just made so we could hang it on the light pole. Way up the top to start with. Then a little later on we made brackets that clamped onto the pole part the way down and hung the stars there.
Mm-hmm.
But they were a little too high when we hung them way up there.
Yeah.
But the pole, each pole had its own little box opening and an outlet. You could plug in inside that pole. You didn't have to hunt for things to plug it into.
Right.
So that simplified it a whole lot.
Yeah. I in the past, I worked for the power company, and I remember them saying that they only wanted to do those smaller decorative metal poles nowadays, unless you were putting transmission line on it or something.
Yeah, right now they've gone back to those down. They're kind of backdating the city.
Exactly. I'm sorry if you...
No, I didn't. I saw those people out there.
Yeah.
She looked at me.
Well, yeah. Well, unless there's anything else, I think that we're all done here. And if it's all right with you, what I can do is take these back to the office with me.
Do that. I had that particularly in this. It has a lot of stuff in it. You just have to go through it. Some of it may be pertinent. Some of it may just be superfluous.
No, we'd be happy to. Again, we have some collections of all these, but it's always funny to see what one person thinks is worth keeping and what another person does.
I've kept, I don't know what all of them here. I've kept a lot of stuff.